This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcast, or go to reason.com/podcast and sign up there. In 1987, just 2 years before the collapse of the Berlin Wall would usher in the beginning of what Francis Fukuyama would later call the end of history, the rock band Guns N' Roses would release Appetite for Destruction, an album that would go on to become the best-selling debut LP in the history of rock and roll. Packed with hits such as Welcome to the Jungle, Sweet Child of Mine, and Paradise City, Appetite for Destruction wasn't just another record. It was a cultural milestone, at once the culmination of decades of trends in popular music and the closing out not just of the rock era, but a society-wide flirtation with excess, fear, anger, and nihilism. For the next 5 years, Guns N' Roses, and particularly the band's frontman, Axl Rose, would personify an America in rapid flux and change, desperate to move on from a worn-out post-war consensus on national identity, gender roles, and global hegemony, and also fearful of change. The new book, Goodbye Guns N' Roses, The Crime, Beauty, and Amplified Chaos of America's Most Polarizing Band by Art Tavana, is an extended essay on the cultural legacy, not just of a band, but of a period that informs contemporary debates on politics and culture, even as that era recedes from our memory. Tavana is an LA-based former writer for Playboy and LA Weekly. He talks with me about the attraction of popular nihilism, Axl Rose as the dispossessed son of middle America, how the band's racist, xenophobic, and homophobic song, One in a Million, captured national anxiety overcoming political, social, and economic change, how the group's beef with Nirvana, another band that couldn't quite make it into the post-Cold War era, illustrates the limits of rock and roll. And he talks about what comes after the end of corporate mass culture. Here is The Reason Interview with Art Tavana. Art Tavana, thanks for talking to Reason.
Cool, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. So give me, what's the elevator pitch of your book? You are writing about a band that was as big as a rock band ever was, but that was also a long time ago. What's up with Guns N' Roses?
I think in a lot of ways, it's an anti-rock bio in the sense that I approached it not as a music history. I tried to determine the DNA of Guns N' Roses and then really like pick it apart and figure out what made them what they are. And what the weirdest part about the book was really experimenting at the time with my own sort of psychology about rock and roll and my rockist sort of bias. And I try to go back in time to who I was when I was like, 7 years old, discovering this band on MTV with Kurt Loder and all that. And I try to figure out, what was it about Axl Rose that was so provocative, so erotic, so dangerous, so strange and bizarre and alluring to me? And then just what is the sort of bad obsession that the fans have with Guns N' Roses that has carried over for the last 30 years? What has kept them so interesting? What has kept them so alluring? How has Axl burnished his myth over the last three decades? I think it had no agenda, which I think made it a bizarre book, because I think every Guns N' Roses book or Rolling Stones book or any rock bio seems to have a purpose. I think like they have a thesis. My thesis was that I have no thesis, but by the end, I think I found my thesis, which was essentially that it's time to sort of say goodbye to the rock star. And it's time to move on and discover new things. But I think Guns N' Roses for me was the last moment in time where there was this nihilistic, hedonistic, mad, crazy, out of control rock star that was accepted by popular culture.
Right. It was celebrated, right?
Celebrated. I mean,
Axl Rose, it's Axl Rose died for our sins, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, or something. So this was a band that was gigantic. You're kind of suggesting they kind of close out the rock era. There are many big, personalities in this band, Axl Rose to begin with, but also Slash, the guitarist, the biracial guitarist who comes across as a dirtbag, but is actually kind of the offspring of a fairly lush Southern California life.
Right.
Axl is the real deal, the god, who grows out of the clay on the banks of the Wabash or something, right? In rural Indiana or in Lafayette, Indiana. Talk about Appetite for Destruction, their first record. And like, what did that what kind of impact did that have? Where did that come from? And why did that capture people's attention to the extent that, and I believe I'm quoting you on this, it is the best-selling debut album ever in recorded music history.
Yeah, in America, it's the best-selling debut album, which is essentially recorded history. I think that Appetite was a complicated sort of animal because in some ways it captures this like raw, mad, crazy, feral rock band, this combination of, you know, you have middle Indiana, rural, redneck, Axl Rose and Izzy, who came from that part of the country. And then you combine that with this, like, you know, this rock and roll genius aristocrat in Slash, who was also this California kid, but also had roots in England. And you have, you know, Steven Adler, you have such a, and you have this punk rock edge with Duff. And there was no band there. See, the thing that made them so unique is they were, in the simplest terms, the most musically talented hair metal band by far. In that moment in time, all the bands on the strip lacked something. Like, they either lacked a musical direction, they either lacked a great frontman, they either lacked a great manager or a great, they all missed. Poison was sort of seen as a farce. You had Bon Jovi, who was like a great band in terms of like ballads and in terms of their sort of party aesthetic, but they weren't really seen as being tough or gritty enough until...
And certainly not dangerous, right?
Certainly not dangerous.
Bon Jovi was the rock star you would bring home to mother.
Yeah. I mean, John Bon Jovi was in teeny bopper magazines and so forth. I'm not taking anything away from the beauty and the fun and the energy of that music, but I think they're missing sort of the down and dirty, you know, early Rolling Stones quality of, would you let your daughter sleep with this guy? I mean, most people would probably have said yes to John Bon Jovi. I think Axl Rose would have been, stay away from my family. Like, he looked dangerous. He was like a young Charlie Manson coming to Los Angeles and trying to make it. I think that's what Axl Rose seemed like to me. But I think that album was legitimately frightening. Like, when I was a kid and I discovered Welcome to the Jungle on MTV, I don't know when it would have been for me, probably 88, 89. I wasn't old enough to like realize what was going on in 87. But for me, it was scary. I was frightened. I thought this was a horror movie for me. This was a slasher flick. This was dystopia. And that sort of, you know, it captures that for me.
Can you, walk us through kind of a reading of that song, Welcome to the Jungle, which was a massive MTV hit, a massive, hit in its own right, and kind of leads off Appetite for Destruction, their debut album. What's going on in the video? What's going on in the song? And what does that capture?
I mean, I think ultimately, and I try to make cinematic references in the book to capture this, but I think it's sort of showing you a side of Los Angeles that the glam metal or hair metal scene was completely ignoring, which was it was similar. And I make this comparison to NWA. It was similar to gangster rap in the sense that it showed a side of LA and that lifestyle that was just not popular and wasn't mainstream. And Guns N' Roses mainstreamed the idea that, you know, living on the edge of society, living on the fringes of society is kind of sexy, erotic, and fun. And in a weird way, it made it sort of, it normalized this idea of being a complete nihilist again and being an absolute, in some ways, a monster. And I think the dark side of that album, as seen in like that first artwork that Robert Williams sort of used, which was this artwork of the quote unquote robot rape cover that was banned, which depicted a young woman being raped by a robot and a giant alien monster. And the, you know, 30,000 copies were made. I think 30,001 was just, that was it. It was banned. And they went back to the crew. They used the sort of the Celtic Cross cover, the famous skulls. But I think it captured this idea that like Los Angeles is raping America. It was this dark, hedonistic, you know, ugly place. And I think Guns N' Roses said, okay, we're going to talk about that. And we're also going to make it like danceable and fun and cool. And like, this has never been done in the hair metal scene or the glam metal scene. So that to me propelled them into mainstream. And suddenly you had the definitive and the only sort of glam metal band to take seriously at that point.
What, in the beginning of the video for Welcome to the Jungle, Axl Rose is getting off a bus, right? Yeah, what's going on in the video?
Yeah, so the video was essentially sort of directed quietly by the manager, Alan Niven. His vision was this combination of Clockwork Orange, Midnight Cowboy. So he was sort of painting this portrait of the feral, you know, hick from Indiana who arrives to Los Angeles, kind of similar to Midnight Cowboy, right? And then, except New York in that sense. But, and discovering the sort of dark, seedy underbelly of the big city. This was a this is literally like a personal account based on Axel's own discovery of, and this kind of goes back and forth, whether it was New York or Los Angeles, but it's sort of a merger of both in his life, because he's hitchhiked through LA and Los and New York. I think for him, he would get off the bus or he would get off the subway and he would see, you know, the big city, right? I mean, he would see hustlers, he would see prostitutes, he would see drug dealers and gang members. And this is a kid who had never even seen a Black person. And now he's seeing them on the streets and he's shocked and he's horrified. And it's his own prejudice comes to life. And I think from that moment, you have One in a Million, which to me is Welcome to the Jungle with no filter, right? It is the it is his true, provocative, unfiltered opinion. But yeah, the video was really a cinematic sort of portrait of what happens when, like, the young, you know, sort of virgin redneck or hillbilly comes to Los Angeles and becomes, you know, kind of, I don't know, like becomes indoctrinated or, you know, baptized.
So this is, let's make it, you know, let's put some like low class and high class glasses on this. It is, you know, he's like the thousandth teenage runaway who goes to, you know, the Hollywood Strip expecting stardom, something darker. But he's also like Rastignac in Balzac's Pere Goriot, where he is a bumpkin who shows up in the city for his education and he realizes he's getting fleeced. And one thing that's interesting about Axel and kind of the band and that song certainly is that, yeah, they get there, they see how depraved it is, and they are going to, you know, they're going to dominate it and relish it and live in it. Talk a little bit about Axl Rose, because he's really the center of the book. And arguably is the center of the band, because he is the one person who has been in Guns N' Roses in all of its various iterations. But who is Axl Rose?
I think he's a complicated figure. I mean, I think he's sort of unexplainable and ungraspable, which is what makes him so interesting. But on a basic level, Axl Rose is a, you know, lower middle class, white, you know, kid from middle Indiana, the sort of not, I wouldn't say the sort of hood in middle Indiana, but sort of, you know, a rural part east of the Wabash River. And, you know, he grew up in a family that was not the best. I mean, his stepfather did physically abuse the kids in the household. Now, not sexually abused Axel, but he did, you know, abuse Axel physically. His biological father, and this according to Axel, based on his own past life regression, sort of hypnosis therapy, sexually abused him. So at the age of two, Axel was raped by his biological father. This is according to his own words. And so, you know, he's dealing with a lot of trauma. He's angry. He's violent. He was a juvenile. He was like the definition of a juvenile delinquent. He was arrested like, I don't know, what, 12 or 15 times in Indiana before he came to Los Angeles. There's several mugshots that, like, you know, show this kid in the 70s who's just, I mean, he was violent. He was out of control. He was a loose cannon. And, you know, he's kind of like, you know.
He's like a quintessential rock kid. He's also a quintessential somebody who, I mean, he grows up in Indiana, which, you know, next to Ohio is the most normal state possible. In a religious setting, but the religion has failed him. The economy has failed him. The family, that unit, right, that is supposed to be so important, has failed him. And he's angry as hell by the time he gets to LA.
Yeah, he grew up in a fundamentalist Pentecostal household. So, you know, he was going to church. He was going to Bible readings. And he was never really, you know, he never really sort of felt a connection to that. And I think he rejected that for the rest of his life. But what I find interesting, he's never really like written about it or done any music about his views on religion. He's never even talked about his views on religion. But I think over the years, he sort of left the church and became more eccentric and sort of started studying, like, you know, past life regression and all these various sort of more Eastern kind of philosophies. But yeah, I think that he was a lost kid, really.
You know, he is also kind of, I mean, he's brilliant. He's a genius in the way that, like, certain, you know, pop musicians are, but he's also kind of incredibly credulous and stupid, right? I mean, like he believes every passing fad, but he's grabbing something from that. What do you, what do you think his invocation of trauma means to him? Like, why, you know, what, how does that ground him in a particular way?
I think his trauma from his childhood, pre-adolescent trauma, informs everything that you know of him as an artist. I think everything on Appetite for Destruction, everything on User Illusion, all those songs are just based fundamentally or rooted in his trauma and then his inability to escape his demons, which sort of infected everything from his romances with Aaron Everly and Stephanie Seymour to his relationship with his friends and his bandmates. And I think he was bipolar. I mean, I think at that point in culture, we weren't really talking about mental health. So I think Axl Rose was just seen as, oh, he's just crazy, you know, but he was bipolar and he was dealing with that in the middle of one of the biggest concert tours in history. And in the middle of all of this, he's becoming famous. He's becoming one of the most, he's literally the most famous rock star in the country or the world. And in the middle of this, he's losing his romance with Aaron Everly. He's going through, you know, he's violently attacking her. He's dealing with his own loss of faith. He doesn't know if he doesn't know how to like ground himself at all. He's paying a psychic to come on tour with him. This woman named Sharon Maynard, AKA Yoda, to come on tour with him and give him sort of like spiritual readings to make him feel better about these towns he's going into. And then he's causing riots and, you know, he's literally, and his bandmates nicknamed him Ayatollah because I think the one thing that Axl Rose always wanted was complete control because it was taken away from him at the age of two, you know.
Right.
And I think he's been struggling his whole career to find that in the middle of being this chaotic sort of hurricane himself.
Yeah. Talk about the song Sweet Child of Mine, which I suspect for a lot of people, especially if they're not, you know, super fans of the band, that is the one song that they know for sure. It is, you know, it pops up everywhere. I don't know, you know, I obviously you do this, but even I, you know, who I had the pleasure of interviewing Slash in 1987 for Smash Hits, the American licensed version of the English song, which I read for. And I mean, I was amazed that he made it to 1988 because he was already like, you know, kind of just as a matter of fact, talking about a level of alcoholism, which is, you know, just off the charts. But Sweet Child of Mine, what is that song about? What does that tell us about the allure and the demons of Guns N' Roses?
Well, that song's unique because that song is based on a poem that Axl was writing Aaron at that point. His first real sort of, not his first romance, but his first major sort of like fiance level romance. And it turned into this like epic song that was basically a joke. So Slash was fiddling with his guitar and doing this arpeggio exercise in the house they lived in at the time, in the Laughlin House in Los Angeles. The record label put him in a house. The record label, according to Tom Zutta, the A&R rep from Geffen who discovered them, they needed a hit. They needed like a song at the center of the album to sort of bridge the chaos of side one and that sort of the darkness of side one, the Guns side and the Rose side, which is sort of the more romantic and the more uplifting side of the album. They needed that song and they wrote that song just out of nowhere, needing a hit essentially. Mm-hmm. And Slash wrote this arpeggio exercise, Duff added this beautiful, sweet, you know, literally a sweet bass line. And then you had Izzy who came up with this really funky chord progression. A pop chord progression. I think it's like you hear this in like Roy Orbison songs, but I think the chord progression really made the song. Axl puts on his, you know, poetry and comes up with this beautiful melody. They tinker with it for a couple months in the studio. And, you know, Spencer Proffer, the producer, really helped sort of define the song. He doesn't get a lot of credit, but he really helped shape the bridge and I think some of the chorus. And then, you know, all of a sudden it catches fire and it becomes a number one hit. And this obscure, slightly roguish, rough, weird, bizarre band from Los Angeles becomes Bon Jovi, becomes the Rolling Stones, becomes the biggest band in America. It's, to me, the most important song in their catalog. Whether it's their best song or not is debatable, but it's the most important.
And it's, I mean, I always found it interesting that it, I almost choke up thinking about it because I lived for a while near Indiana and like you can see somebody like Axl Rose wanting to have like an uncomplicated love you know, just a sweet, beautiful love. But that song gets disrupted partway through because it has to get chaotic at some point, right? Because nothing can last for more than a few minutes in kind of the universe that Axl Rose and Guns N' Roses exists in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a beautiful song. It's one of the most important MTV era ballads. But I think the thing that made it unique is that it's a ballad, but it's not overly sentimental. It's not, you know, it's not cheesy or it's not a power ballad, but it's a ballad that's got a Southern rock groove, almost like Lynyrd Skynyrd tracks. And I think that gives it an energy that's very different. Again, they were doing everything to stick out from the glam metal. So they didn't want to be Journey. They didn't want to be Bon Jovi or Poison. They were just different. It's an unusual ballad. And it connected with, and it's unique because it connected with the teenager, sort of like 13-year-old girl, as much as it connected with the 45-year-old MTV executive, right? I mean, that is unheard of in rock and roll, to have a song that can connect with everyone in the culture. We don't have that today.
The third song that I would argue kind of defines them, you mentioned it in passing, One in a Million. Right. This was notorious. It's not off the first album, but even for a time when people were, you know, I think kind of more accepting of like off the cuff, certainly gay slurs towards gays, immigrants. But this song also uses the N-word.
Yep.
In a way that it hadn't been heard in a by a white singer is probably since John Lennon's song, Woman is the N-Word of the World.
Right.
What's going on in One in a Million?
So I think, okay, so around 1987, 88, I think right when they're breaking, Axl sort of, I think it's a, it depends on who you believe, right? It depends on if you believe Axl Rose or you believe his representation or the people who are around him. It could have been a dark joke. It could have been an honest, unfiltered reflection on his arrival in Los Angeles. It could have been a combination of both. It could have been his attempt to troll his own fan base and the media. Ultimately, no one really knows the answer to that. I think personally, my reflections on it, my point of view is that it was an unfiltered, completely journal. It was him writing in his diary and publishing it for the whole world to see. I think everything he says in that song is how he felt the moment he arrived in Los Angeles and New York for that matter. And this is his raw, honest reflections. I mean, he legitimately, the story about him going to a 7-Eleven and this sort of Persian, I guess, employee there attacking him in slash and yelling at him and just saying, get out of the store because they're, you know, they're being punks and him being angry and saying, who are you? You don't even speak English, you know, and it's very sort of like you said, I think that. Or I think someone said this online once, it was sort of the proto-Trump supporter in the sense that like he was the white working class expressing himself completely without filter. He felt like, you know, yeah, why are there these Middle Easterners here who are not, you know, contributing to society or quote unquote learning English? It's all Greek to him and so forth, right?
Yeah.
And he reflects on that.
But by the same token, I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about, and particularly if it grows out of the incident in a 7-Eleven or a convenience store.
Right.
You know, the Iranian is actually working, right? The immigrant is working. He talks at various points about, gay men coming on to him and him, you know, flipping out. You know, and it's funny because this stuff is, you know, we use a different language now. We'll talk about, homophobia or heteronormativity or whatnot. Axl Rose encompasses a vision of a white America that has completely lost, right? I mean, it's in a bad situation and it's just filled with anger. Can I ask you, as a kind of byproduct of this, because you love this band, right? You write an entire book about them. You write incredibly poetically and movingly about kind of what they tap into. When you hear, you yourself are Iranian American, you're Persian American. When you hear a song like One in a Million, how does that affect you? Because you clearly see an art in it, or something of value, even as it's kind of attacking your people.
Well, it's odd because, so I came to the United States at the age of two, right? Two, almost three. I really have no sort of connection to any country really. And when I came here, my mother is Armenian and Georgian. I wasn't raised by my dad, who's the Persian half of my sort of ancestry, right? So I never really had a connection to any sort of nationality or ethnicity really. That's important because for me, had I had that, like, for example, if I was a black man or if I was, and I was listening to this song, I would feel very differently about it. I think for me, I did not, when I was younger, it was all about the melody. It was all about the groove. It was all about the feeling. And I didn't really connect the shock and the awe and the horror of the song until I got older. I think when I got to college probably is when I was like, oh my God, he wrote this song and released this song. Like,
right.
It was so absurd and like ridiculous.
It is a song that is so shocking. I mean, it kind of makes when the band releases, when they cover a song written by Charles Manson, it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, that's not so bad compared to this song.
Not at all. I mean, this song is, I mean, look, they re-released Appetite as a box set 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and this song was left out of that box set. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an Appetite-only box set. It was all their, like, 88, 87 collection, 80 and 89. This was left off. I think Axl regrets it. I think Axl feels a lot of shame and guilt for it, believe it or not. But I think at that moment, he wrote exactly how he felt when he was in Los Angeles at the peak of his sort of, you know, what is going on? This is not America. I don't know people. And so, like, you know, he was, in his story, in his argument for why he wrote, why he used the F word, a homophobic slur, was because he was allegedly almost raped by a gay truck driver who held a razor blade to his head. And, I mean, sort of like this whole, like, there's this whole story about that. But, and he says openly, I'm homophobic because I was almost raped by someone who's, and I was also almost raped by my biological father. So he justifies the song in the crudest and the ugliest ways in his interviews. I think the craziest part about the whole thing is every time he was interviewed after One in a Million, he couldn't explain. He couldn't just one say, this is how I felt then. Maybe I don't feel that way now. I don't know how I feel now. He just kind of justified it in bizarre ways. So, like, he would justify everything with a story that made him, that justified his anger and rage towards certain communities. And even the you know, his sort of discomfort about AIDS. It's just like this very primitive view of what AIDS was and this idea that, like, you know, it was a quote unquote gay disease. I mean, that's what he was pushing into the song, which is shocking to think, but, like, you know, it's also really honest. I mean, that's what he—that's what he felt, right? I mean,
this seems like of a piece, you know, with a late '80s, early '90s culture. You know, and the I mean, the Cold War is still going on, so there's, you know, and you know, the Appetite for Destruction in the background, I guess, literally, right? There's a mushroom cloud somewhere,
right?
But, you know, there's that going on, but then there's the breakdown of the world, you know, of the kind of Beaver Cleaver world. You would hear a lot of people in American music talking about how, you know, the Brady Bunch, you know, the Robert Reed, the father who played the actor who played the father in Brady Bunch, had died of AIDS. And that was some kind of metaphor that America had been showing us this one image of, like, a happy, religious, peaceful, even white place that was actually diseased and everything was falling apart. And that seems to, you know, it's a kind of Andrew Dice Clay routine, whether he, you know, and Clay goes back and forth in terms of talking about whether he was ironic at the time or he got irony once he started getting shut down. But it seems very much of a piece with all of that.
So for Axl, just so, I mean, you and your listeners know, he claims most of, a part of that song, at least, was influenced by Sam Kinison.
Mm-hmm.
So he was watching a bunch of Sam Kinison sort of specials. And, you know, there's that famous sort of gay necrophiliac joke that Kinison had that was infamous. I think he borrowed from that energy. He borrowed from the shock jock comedian energy that was by 1988, 89 already becoming very unacceptable. I mean, Dice Clay was already sort of like, you know, he was... His shock factor, the shock factor was wearing off, and Axl was like, you know what, I'm going to go with this. I think Axl Rose was being a shock jock and trying to say that I'm funny, I'm irreverent, I'm also really smart, I have an interesting point of view, and I'm just going to put it out there. If you remember, this video clip's on YouTube somewhere, the only live performance we have of One in a Million recorded is at CBGB's in 88, and they perform it, and everyone laughs. When he uses the N-word, everyone laughs. When he uses the F-word, everyone laughs. It was almost like everyone was in on this joke. I watch it. I don't think it's funny. I'm not trying to be, like, you know, politically correct about the language usage. It is what it is. But I don't think it's funny. It seems like an honest opinion. He's reflecting on how he felt. It wasn't a joke to me, but I think a lot of people saw it as dark humor, which is the mystery of the song. Is it dark humor or is it Axl Rose being completely, you know, blunt and deranged,
racist, homophobic,
xenophobic.
You know, so one of the things that's interesting, and it comes up in the book a little bit, is, you know, this idea of kind of closing out the rock era. Not, you know, there's still obviously rock music and, you know, popular music more generally and all of that kind of stuff, but, like, this kind of classic era of rock, you know, which maybe begins with Elvis, but it kind of like the artistic side of it is sometime in the mid 60s. And it might be, you know, the emergence of the Beatles as like serious artists, Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground, Jim Morrison and the Doors, certainly.
Absolutely.
Morrison, in a lot of ways, is the personification of like Dionysius as a, you know, as the ultimate rock star who, of course, must die, right, from his excess. And Axl Rose is certainly trafficking in that. But, you know, there's by the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, that's clearly that moment has passed. Music has gotten so varied and so different. It's not cohering around versions of Jim Morrison or Robert Plant or whoever. The other band that comes up, and you know, Guns N' Roses, and is Nirvana, which in its own way is a collection of kind of misfit sons. It's important that they're men. They're kind of like boy men of America, of an America that has not, you know, that has let them down on some way. Can you talk a little bit about the, you know, the interactions between Guns N' Roses and Nirvana, and what do they represent, and why do they hate each other so much?
Okay. So this is a really funny story because no one's really sort of done a really good job of explaining this. I think I spent probably 40 pages of the book trying to explain how this started. I think fundamentally it comes down to the sort of clash between hard rock or heavy metal and punk, which has always been sort of this since the 70s, essentially. Right. They've always been at odds because one is very theatrical, one is very macho and masculine. One is very sort of, you know, Broadway. And then you have another.
And that's heavy metal.
That's heavy metal. And you have punk, which is gritty, basic. In some ways, later, at least at this point in the culture, a third wave feminist kind of movement, right? I mean, it was in the 70s, but certainly by 1991, 92, with the emergence of Riot Girl, you have this sort of, this weird merger of the male-centric Kurt Cobain, Seattle, you know, grunge scene. Which wasn't sort of filled with a lot of women. And then you had Riot Girl and Kathleen Hanna. So you had feminism bashing heads with literally the patriarchy's like number one genre, which is heavy metal, right? That is the core of it, right? But I think what it was, and this is actually to credit Axl Rose, he saw early on, even before Nirvana was released on the mainstream, that this was going to be a great fucking band because he heard that tape. He heard the recordings at Geffen Studio. So he had this sense that, okay, this band is going somewhere and I need to get involved with this band because I think they're the future. He saw that. So he immediately reached out to Nirvana and he immediately wanted to tour with them. And I mean, he wanted Nirvana to tour with Guns N' Roses. Kurt Cobain flatly denied doing it, said, I would never do tour with Guns N' Roses. There was a quiet period. And then I think Axl, this is a rumor, but I think Axl supposedly asked Kurt Cobain to play his birthday. And Kurt Cobain obviously chose not to. And then there was a Vanity Fair article on Kurt Cobain and Courtney. And in that famous article, this is when the commentary starts about like, you know, we're not Guns N' Roses. So I think Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love saw an opportunity to use Guns N' Roses as kind of the, this is who we're not. If you don't like Guns N' Roses and you don't like homophobia and you don't like racism and you don't like masculinity and you don't like all this bullshit, Nirvana's the band for you. It was a marketing strategy and it worked perfectly. Axl Rose was turned into the fool and Kurt Cobain was turned into the new sort of androgynous feminist icon. And it wasn't disingenuous or inorganic. It was just perfectly executed. I think Courtney Love deserves a lot of credit because she knew how to communicate that to the public. Whereas Kurt Cobain was still trying to figure it out.
So, and then, you know, you do an artful job of talking about the, you know, the ways in which, you know, various people around Axl Rose in particular, you know, were like kind of pushing him to be the next Jim Morrison, which has an implication in it that like, you know, you got to die to really fulfill the mission. You know, like this is, you are Jesus, you're rock Jesus, and Jesus must die in order to fulfill his ambition. And it's kind of ironic then that it's Kurt Cobain who dies, right? And not Axl Rose. And can you just kind of dilate on that a little bit? And then I want to talk about kind of the demise of Guns N' Roses and its classic phase and what comes next, because it is, so just talk a little bit about that.
So I think the sort of sanctification of Jim Morrison that started really in the 70s and the 80s, and I think Danny Sugarman, who was the manager of Doors at one point.
And also, he wrote the book No One Here Gets Out Alive.
Yes and no. Right? He's credited mostly for writing it. He was involved in writing it, but so basically, yes, he wrote.
In the late 70s, that book came out and it created a whole new, it really created the love for the Doors that has not really abated, but their songs were re-released. Some of them topped the charts, things like that.
That book defined the mythology of Jim Morrison. And it actually sort of, I think in many ways, it was an exaggerated portrayal. I think that's the portrayal you see in the Oliver Stone film, which is cartoonish, campy, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the ultimate Dionysus figure. It's funny. It's almost unreal. It's just a massive orgy, right? Danny Sugarman had his eyes sort of locked on Axl Rose because there's a lot of background to this that's not in the book, but I think, and managers were dealing with Danny a lot. Sort of Al Niven, the former manager, dealt with that Danny Sugarman a lot. Danny was convinced that Axl was the reincarnation of Jim Morrison. This was like his official point of view. And he knew Axl wasn't very educated. And he knew Axl had no sort of background or knowledge like Greek myth or even really Jim Morrison. You got to remember, Axl was listening to was not the Doors at all. Axl did not know a lot about Jim Morrison by that point. So Danny was like, dude, you're the new Jim Morrison. They're sitting at the Hamburger Hamlet, having a soda and a burger. And he's like, you're the new Jim Morrison. And this is why. And here's the sort of the Greek lineage to you and Jim and the Freudian death drive. And he was like, he's basically convinced Axl that to be great, to be the next Morrison, you must die. And then Axl, to his credit, and this is where Axel's unique, right? He stopped Danny and said, no, I don't want to die. I visited Morrison's grave. I thought it was, it was cool, but I don't want to be that person. I want to be Mick Jagger, right? I want to be the CEO of Guns N' Roses and the biggest fucking rock band in the world. I want to make $1 million every week. And I want to be the face of rock and roll on MTV. I don't want to be dead at 27 years old. And Axl Rose said 27 was the hardest year of his life because he was constantly evading death. And so that's sort of the lineage between those two sort of creatures. And I think that is what in many ways, that's what Kurt Cobain was rejecting, was the Danny Sugarman version of Axl Rose, right? Like the rock star, which ultimately in the great tragedies, Kurt Cobain himself said he wished he could have been that kind of rock star when he killed himself. Mm-hmm. He wrote about Freddie Mercury and the lights and the spotlight. And I think part of this all always goes back to sort of Kurt's inferiority complex, in the sense that he can never be the front man that Axl Rose was. And I think that bothered him deeply. And I think that's sort of a part of a small kernel of where the rage for Axl comes from. And I think the same for Axl, which was he could never be the poet that Kurt was. So
what's weird though is, Nirvana ends with the death of Kurt Cobain, and we could spend a couple of years just kind of talking about all of the cross currents of these two bands and of music in that period. But fundamentally, Axl Rose dies too, right? And Guns N' Roses dies. Can you talk, and he gets reborn, kind of as Elvis in Vegas, really, which is, I don't think anybody saw that coming. But talk about what happens after that first, 4 or 5 year run for Guns N' Roses, where they are just, on fire and bigger and bigger and bigger. How does the first phase of Guns N' Roses end? And what does that tell us about kind of, the world at large?
So I think the User Illusion Tour was sort of the beginning and the end of, like, it was like the ultimate culmination of arena rock. And I think Axl was at the center of it, not just as like the face of that sort of dying scene, just as punk rock was emerging from the sort of the underground, but he also became the target, because MTV, the punk rock world, everybody was looking at Axl Rose as, who the fuck is this guy? Like, how does someone like this exist? The costumes he was wearing were like outrageous. He was running around stage in like, these short white bicycle shorts and a Charles Manson t-shirt. And he was wearing a baseball catcher's uniform at one point. And he was just stopping concerts because in Giant Stadium in 1988, someone threw a lighter and it collided with his crotch. And he's like, I'm done. Yeah. I'm done with this concert. And then like people were like, what do you mean? Like, we just paid like, $25 at that time, which is like whatever, like $60 now. We're like, we want to see a concert. And he's like, I'm done. I'm going home. And that sort of was the beginning of the end. And I think Axl, and this is a defense of Axl, I think, he was legitimately losing his mind at this point. He was dealing with intense trauma. He was doing 4 to 5 hours of psychotherapy every day. He was working out, like obsessively working out every single minute of every day on his Stairmaster. His legs were ripped. His body was shredded. He was on these bizarre vitamins that most people don't even know what they were. He was on the verge of, he was like Henry Rollins in Black Flag when he would pull people on stage or like bash their heads in with the mic stand because he was so enraged with the world. Like he was just, the world around him was crumbling. And then Kurt Cobain saw that and said, oh, okay, he's an idiot. Let's make fun of him because right. It's funny, right? It's like funny because he's a moron. He's this like typical like masculine goofball. Let's just bag on him and make fun of him. And Courtney Love was like, oh my God, this is too easy. And I think the 1992 MTV Awards were the sort of the beginning of a goodbye to Guns N' Roses. And that was the culmination of Nirvana and GNR colliding on the biggest stage in music at that time. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately what happened was Guns N' Roses seemed like the past and Nirvana seemed like the future at that moment. Right. And I think when Kurt Cobain killed himself, in many ways, Axl Rose died because it was Kurt Cobain fulfilled the legacy of the 27 Club. And Axl just became an old, kind of out of touch, lost and confused sort of rock star in Malibu.
And then he becomes kind of like, a new version of Brian Wilson, where he is endlessly fiddling on a long promised, long delayed album, Chinese Democracy.
Right.
I mean, we're skipping over stuff a little bit here, but you know, he basically cashiers the rest of the band and picks up along the way. I mean, it's like a Bergman movie or something where he's, you know, he picks up a member from the Replacements, right. You know, a couple of, I mean, it's just like insane to come up with Chinese Democracy, which, talk a bit about that and how that plays into the afterlife of, you know, Guns N' Roses, the band that people fundamentally care about, the one that adolescents like you and me were willing to cut our veins for, you know, that died in 91, 92, 93, maybe at the latest. But talk a little bit about the road to Chinese Democracy and after that.
So for most fans, the Guns N' Roses as we know it, right? The logo, the images, the aesthetic, the visceral band ended in 1994. Axl Rose made his last sort of public appearance as the Axl Rose that we know at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony. He was performing alongside, was it Springsteen? I forgot, but he performed at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony. He was wearing like these like combat boots. He looked different. His beard had grown out. His voice changed a little bit. He looked almost grunge. And that's when everyone's like, is he trying to be like more grunge? And then he vanished. Axl Rose, this is sort of known as the wilderness years, right? So from 1994 to about 2000, nobody really saw Axl Rose. He was in Malibu recording this bizarre album called Chinese Democracy. He was apparently fiddling with his looks, maybe possibly having plastic surgery, possibly going through weird sort of religious rituals that he's sort of alluded to here and there. He got sued by his ex-wife. He got sued by his alleged fiance for abuse. He went through that. He went through the breakup with Stephanie Seymour, which destroyed him by all accounts. He lost touch with reality in many ways. And then all of a sudden in the year 2000, roughly, he emerges with, you know, he doesn't have cornrows yet, but he emerges looking completely different. He doesn't have eyebrows. Like he shaved off his eyebrows. His skin looked different. His face looked different. His voice sounded different. And then he was sort of fiddling with this bizarre rapper, almost industrial aesthetic. He had a baggy football jersey all of a sudden. He was wearing leather pants that were like the kind of things you'd see on MC Hammer or something. And he looked very strange. And I remember this because the 2002 MTV Awards were the end for me for a long time. I think from 2002 to about maybe when Chinese Democracy came out, I was done.
What's that? That's like 2006, is that right?
08. It came out in 08. So in 2002, they did the 2002 MTV Awards. Axl Rose came out, it was a disaster. He lost his breath. He couldn't really sing. His band was sort of not really ready for that performance. He's fiddling with his earpiece the whole time. He has cornrows out of nowhere. He had his hair done, I think, a week prior to that performance. maybe even a couple days prior to that performance, he just came out with corn. Like, he decided to showcase his return to rock and roll looking like a cross between the Predator, you know, in the Schwarzenegger film, and like some bizarre sort of like, I don't know, like sci-fi and fiber optic sort of cornrows. He looked like an absolute monster, and it was crazy. As a Guns N' Roses fan, I was absolutely shocked.
He was making, and we didn't quite know it yet, but he was making Buckethead kind of seem normal.
Yes, and so he has his guitar player next to him who has a giant KFC bucket reversed on his head with a Michael Myers mask, who, everyone at that point thought it was Slash, right, in costume for some bizarre reason. And, you know, and Buckethead's phenomenally talented, yeah. But Buckethead, that's a whole different story. I mean, he was apparently like masturbating in a chicken coop while he was recording Chinese Democracy. Right. I mean, there's a lot of, it gets really interesting.
It's a parody of rock and roll excess, right?
It really is. But Buckethead was just a very enigmatic, bizarre, psychotic character. Mm-hmm. You know, really was almost like a sociopath in the,
yeah.
And then actually at that point, it was like, oh my God, what's happened? Guns N' Roses is over. It's like, this is not the band that I grew up with. And I think at that point, there were people who were 16, 15, discovering Guns N' Roses as Chinese. And I know these people. I've interviewed and talked to these kids. That to them is Guns N' Roses, the Chinese Democracy band that you and I probably look at as kind of a bizarre circus,
yeah,
is the definitive Guns N' Roses for some people. And people forget, right, that, you know, that really, yeah, is the band they love. They love Buckethead. They love Tommy Stinson. They love Robin Fink. I mean, you know, to them, Appetite for Destruction is boring. But for me at that point, you know, Guns N' Roses was over.
Yeah. And Chinese Democracy, is better, I think, than anybody really expected it to be, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's an unfinished masterpiece.
Yeah, it's, but like the Smile record and a couple of other, you know, mythical, you know, never completed or taking forever records. And this is true of novels, too. Like, when they come out, you realize, you know, you really can't afford to take that much time off, you know, because the world moves on beyond you. And even if you're the greatest rock star in the world and the best genius, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it took 14 years, you know, to make that album. So.
Yeah. And, you know, very few things are worth waiting for, you know, 14 weeks, much less 14 months. Let's kind of move forward to the, you know, you talk about going to a famous show that the, you know, almost the complete band redid in 2016. Set the scene for that, and how did that make you feel? And then I want to kind of do a quick, you know, where are they now of the various band members?
Sure. But, so
what was that show?
So in April, around early in 2016. I was notified that Guns N' Roses were probably getting back together. I had an inside sort of source with the band, right? Mm-hmm. And then I got a phone call the day before, in March. I got a phone call at the end of March 2016. I got a phone call from my source who said, be at the in front of the Tower Records on Sunset Strip tomorrow morning as early as you can. And I was like, for what? He goes, Guns N' Roses are getting back together. And I was like, they're going to have a show. He's like, yeah, they're going to have a show. Axl and Slash is back. It's going to happen. Just be there. Wait in line. You'll get your wristband. And you're going to be the only reporter there because you're the only reporter I'm inviting. I can't say who the source was. It is what it is. But I go to the Sunset Strip that night at like midnight. And there's a line building in front of the Tower Records. So I wait in the line with all the sort of hardcore, insane fans. And we wait for, I think, 10 hours or something. And then we get our wristbands the next morning. It's a bizarre, uneventful process, but we got our wristbands. I go to the show that night, or the next night, April 1st, right? April Fool's Day. Every single person who was waiting in line and walked into that room thought it was a joke, right? It's April Fool's Day. There's no fucking way Slash and Axl Rose are getting back together after 23 years of not talking to each other at all. No sign of reconciliation. We were all standing there thinking this is a joke. We're going to be punked. Like Ashton Kutcher is going to walk on stage or something. And this is going to be a big, like confetti is going to fall from, we're going to be like on like MTV or something. But no, it was like, they walked out, like Axl walks out, Slash walks out, Duff walks out. And I've never seen like a religious moment. Like I've never seen people witness their God or their cult leader. I've never been in the middle of a cult. I've never seen Donald Trump rallies where these like women or men are like foaming from the mouth. Oh my God, look, it's fucking, you know, I've never seen any. Okay. This was the only time I saw that moment. I saw this woman next to me who was literally frozen with her eyes wide open, mouth wide open, tears flowing down her face because Axl Rose was standing next to Slash. And I felt it completely. I felt the, I'm getting goosebumps as I talk to you about it because I felt that moment completely. I felt literally sick to my stomach. It was so, like, it was so eventful. I was washed over by nostalgia, you know? And so I review the show. I'm the only reporter there. I'm the only journalist who's at the show somehow, right? I review it. I talk about how amazing it was and how, you know, shocking and exciting and the energy was just overflowing. And then like 6 months later, I get this like, and there's no video of this concert, by the way, officially, but I got like an HD sort of, I don't know, someone shot something and sent it to me and I watched it and I was shocked at how bad it was. I mean, the Axl's vocals were not there. The band sounded off. Everything was disastrous. They looked bizarre. Axl was like sweating and he looked out of shape. The fans were like not really feeling it when you watch the video. People are just frozen. It felt like I had been, I felt like what I had seen in person and what I witnessed on film were two different experiences, right? And so that inspired that final chapter in the book, which my goodbye to Guns N' Roses, because I'm in my point of view, that for me was what it is now. It is a nostalgia experience. And when you try to analyze nostalgia from like a student or a scholarly perspective, you see the flaws in the machinery. Mm-hmm. And the minute I saw the flaws in the machinery, I was like, I'm done. I have nothing to gain from this band anymore. They're beautiful. They're interesting. They have something to offer as a roller coaster ride or a theme park ride for people, but that's what it is now. It's a roller coaster ride. It's a theme park. You know?
Let's very quickly just do updates of the original members or the main members. You know, so what is Axl Rose doing now? It's 2021. Do we know?
As far as I know, he's in Latigo Canyon, Malibu, living in a compound that's a beautiful mansion. He's allegedly they're preparing for some sort of tour soon-ish to restart the Not In Us Lifetime tour. So that's all we know. He's, right. he's the most sort of private member of the band. So we don't know really what he's doing. There is talks of a new album. They're working on music, but how far that's along, no one knows.
What about Slash, the guitarist who, you know, was unbelievably exciting. You know, I mean, there were the Eddie Van Halens of the world and things like that, but Slash was kind of the first new type of guitarist. The fact that he was black and white and he worked with people like Michael Jackson while being one of the most decadent and like kind of out there guitarists. You know, what is Slash up to?
Slash, I think, is working on music at all times. I mean, I think he's going to do something with Miles Kennedy again before probably even Guns N' Roses record anything. I think he's on standby to record the new Guns N' Roses material if it ever happens. And I think he's just living his life. And, you know, he's living in Los Angeles. I don't know beyond that. Any, you know, I think he's working on, he has a horror film production company, but I don't think they're actually making anything at the moment.
So then there's Steven Adler, who was kicked out of the band. You know, and it's saying something that you can get kicked out of a band for too much drug use. But it got in the way of him being able to play. He reappeared a decade or more ago on Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew and Sober House, literally as a gibbering idiot because he had had a stroke. You know, that was he was addled. He had a problem from an overdose. What is Steven Adler up to?
No one really knows. I think recently, I think it was about a year ago where he either accidentally stabbed himself or tried to kill himself. No one really knows. He was in the hospital for a period. He came out. He was touring way before COVID. He was touring with the Adler Band, I think they're called, like his version of a Guns N' Roses cover band, which is sort of sad, I think, in a lot of ways. But other than that, I don't really know what Steven Adler's up to. I hope he's okay. That's, I think,
so,
you know.
What, and now one of the more interesting characters is Duff McKagan, who has had one of the greatest post-Guns N' Roses careers out of them. But what is Duff McKagan up to?
I don't really know. I think Duff, when he, you know, when Guns N' Roses sort of faded in the 90s, he recovered. He became an he started doing kickboxing and he got in shape and he wrote like a lot of, I think he wrote a self-help finance book. He also wrote his biography. As far as I know, I don't know if he still has a column at Seattle Weekly. He might.
Right. Well, and he had become a certified financial planner then.
Yeah.
Him and Gibby from the Butthole Surfers, like, who knew that these were, you know, actuarially sound people. And Duff McKagan looks better now than he did in his 20s, which is always fascinating.
Yeah, he looks like he's in great shape. I don't know what he's doing. Yeah. I think he had an album that came out 2 or 3 years ago, solo project. Mm-hmm. So I think he's working on probably another solo project, if I had to guess. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, of the original members, in any case, there's Izzy Stradlin, who was at, you know, from the same town as Axl Rose from, you know, Indiana. And he in many ways, he was the most prolific songwriter, but also probably the quietest. Talk a little bit about him and give just a kind of capsule summary of what he brought to the band and why he's of interest.
So by all accounts, Izzy was kind of the original Guns N' Roses, right? I mean, his aesthetic, his attitude, his idea of bringing darkness and sort of the rock and roll Keith Richards mentality of like the Rolling Stones to the LA music scene was an Izzy Stradlin invention. According to a lot of people that know him and know Guns N' Roses at that point, he was responsible for changing their look from the hair metal, glam metal aesthetic towards something a little more, you know, a little more rock and roll, a little more biker gang, a little more, you know, edge. And I think that's what he brought to the band. He was also probably the most prolific and talented songwriter overall. This is debatable. I mean, I think people will say mm-hmm. Axl contributed more to their like success with Sweet Child. But I mean, again, Izzy wrote the chord progression for that song. He wrote a lot of their greatest, you know, he was the backbone of the band. Culturally, I think he was the backbone of the band. He was the only thing that was keeping Axl Rose in check for a long time. I think the minute Izzy left around 1991, that was, you literally saw the band just, you know, go out, it spun out of control. Mm-hmm. And he's completely become a very sort of eccentric, you know, he's gone into his own Howard Hughes phase. He's vanished from the public eye. He has not made a public appearance, I don't think, in years. He's done a few solo albums, but he's never promoted any of them. He's never done anything with, he hasn't done a Guns N' Roses-ish performance since like the mid-2000s, where I think he did a show, like one show with Axl in Vegas. As far as I know, the reason why he's not part of the reunion is because they refused to pay him equal share, because they viewed him as no longer a foundational member. They viewed him as now you're a supporting cast member now. And so he felt insulted by that and he never joined the band again. And I think now he's either in Malibu or Lafayette, Indiana, somewhere between those. He's a surfer. He plays his acoustic guitar. He lives a great life. I think he's the most interesting member. He's the person that I'd want to interview more than anybody, but he's just a ghost. Really,
you know, I guess just to, as a final kind of conversation point, and I realize part of this is getting old, but you know, the ecstasy that a band like Guns N' Roses conjured in people, mostly men, but not only. And I can remember when they broke, the women I worked with as well as the men, everybody was kind of knocked out. If you were into music, this was just like, oh my God, this is like. It was simultaneously new and the distillation of, you know, it was what Led Zeppelin was striving to become, or the Rolling Stones were striving to become, or a million other bands. It was the something new and the summation of everything that came before it. But, you know, and we talked a little bit about the idea of the rock era being dead. And it's kind of interesting to think about, you know, Johnny Rotten in Pill wanted to kill the guitar solo at various points. He had a whole kind of theory about this and whatnot. It is kind of true that figure is dead. They still kind of exist, but they're not dominant the way they were. Do you think, when you think about a band like Guns N' Roses, and, you know, what's great is that, you know, and in the subtitle, you say the crime, the beauty, the amplified chaos of America's most polarizing band. I mean, the world that they talked about, it's like the Velvet Underground, you know, they are grotesque nihilists, like moral monsters in many ways, and in their real lives. I mean, Axl Rose is, you know, is not a good person went through very bad phases. But are we past that kind of ecstasy that gets created in certain moments of popular culture and rock, or, you know, music in particular, or has it gone to other places? And if so, where are some of those places?
So I think we're beyond that phase on a mainstream level. I think the corporations and brands and, you know, that industry has completely taken over popular culture. I think when popular culture was becoming what it was in the 90s and the 80s, I think we had this battle going on. There was a rebellion against the machine from the artists. I think the artists are now the machine. So it doesn't really exist on the mainstream. Now on the underground, I have to be clear, on the underground, and if you're searching for music on a daily basis like I do, there are great rock and roll bands, phenomenal fronts, like phenomenal singers, phenomenal guitar players. They exist. They're just not on the mainstream because rock and roll, the genre itself, has faded from the mainstream culture. I don't know how that happened. It's really hard. It's a longer story. But I think right now what we're seeing is I see Kurt Cobain in Billie Eilish. I see Axl Rose in Lana Del Rey. I see, you know what I mean? Like I see the energy. I feel everything with Lana Del Rey that I felt, believe it or not, with Axl Rose. Doesn't make much sense because one is chaotic, one is frenetic, and one is narcotic and a downer in a lot of ways and sort of melancholic, but I feel the same energy. Billie Eilish, I think for a 13-year-old right now, is Kurt Cobain.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're not saying the same things because they can't. Right. Corporate America's ended rebellion on a mass level, I think. It's sad, but it's just what it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because that one of the critiques that Frank Sinatra made of rock and roll, you know, this is back in the late 50s, was that it was corporate music, that it was phony and fake and manufactured. And of course, as he was saying, that rock was the insurgent mode. It, you know, very few national labels wanted to put out rock records. It was mostly left to small labels and regional record companies and things like that. But you're kind of saying that, you know, that is kind of what's happened, and maybe not just with rock. I mean, somebody like Billie Eilish is a good example, and Lana Del Rey as well, where they're both extremely artistic, but they're also very mainstream. But it's weird, and particularly somebody like Eilish, her music is weird.
Very weird.
And she has created a massive audience for it, which is like, you know, really phenomenal. But you're saying, I mean, overall, that the kind of the ability of the artists and or the corporations that they create around them kind of make it less likely that you're going to see somebody as weirdly out of control like Axl Rose burn as brightly for as long as he did.
Well, again, so in a weird way, although it's very indirect, I think Lana Del Rey in her early sort of first 5 years of sort of breaking was out of control, was chaos, was weird, was shocking, was unexplainable, was hated by the critics, was, and even now she is in a lot of ways. I think she is polarizing. She is strange. I mean, I think the critics don't like her for a lot of different reasons. And a lot of it has to do with her views or her comments or her behavior or a normalization of things that they don't feel comfortable with. So there is that energy of rebellion and, you know, chaos and destruction and nihilism. I mean, I think in many ways, Lana Del Rey is more of a nihilist than Axl Rose. But I think the way they communicate that message is different. Whereas Axl Rose was causing riots and physically assaulting people in the audience of his own shows and getting arrested and literally fucking shit up. I think nowadays you see Lana and Billy and the various sort of pop stars, even like, you know, Lil Nas X, they make a statement. And then they have to deal with the consequences. And they spend so much time trying to do damage control that they're afraid, because fundamentally nowadays, your team around you can extinguish you really quickly. Whereas in those days, Axl Rose can do whatever the fuck he wanted to do. There was no chance Geffen Records was going to drop him. There was no chance his bandmates were going to be like, we're not talking to you anymore. Bye. There was no publicist who was going to be like, I'm not going to represent Axl Rose. Now, if Billie Eilish or if Lana Del Rey did something truly transgressive and dangerous, they would be dropped by their label and their publicist would never talk to them again and they would not be able to function or make a living. Whereas, you know, in the Kurt Loder era of MTV, that was accepted and actually that was something people wanted. That was money then, right? I don't know. Things have changed.
Well, that's always true. And it's both always a good thing and kind of tragic. Things have changed. I want to thank Art Tavana, the author of Goodbye Guns N' Roses, The Crime, Beauty, and Amplified Chaos, of America's Most Polarizing Band, for talking to Reason. Art, pleasure talking with you.
Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts. Thanks for listening. This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.